Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 5th of March 2021 and you're listening to me, Savannah Longshanks, streaming live tonight at radioalbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic victors of World War II and the soon to be released Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis.
How are you doing, sir?
How are you doing? I'm doing very well. It's been a lovely, beautiful, sunny day today, but more to the point, how are you doing? We haven't heard from you for so long. It was so wonderful to have you back last week. How is life for you?
Just the same, miserable. No, I'm joking. No, it's okay. I'm quite enjoying a pleasant batch researching again and looking for the odd little diamond.
Enjoying your good health at the moment and getting back to researching.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent, excellent. And I hear the DVD sales are doing well.
Yes.
Go on, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, that's at monetarypublishing.com and they've taken onto themselves to sell the DVD, which wasn't on sale for quite a long time. And next week, at least, or the week after, then we're hoping to have Communism by the Back Door on sale as well, which somebody kindly said in an email just the other day was just as important as The Greatest Story Never Told, which I said at the time, but I didn't realise that, you know, we'd have this communist invasion so early.
Yeah, I guess it takes a while. They've got to work on producing the first one, Greatest Story Never Told, and then get the next one out, Communism by the Back Door. They've both been out on DVD before, but Freemasonic Victors hasn't been out on DVD before, has it?
No, that's right, and that'll be the third one of the project, yeah.
And then hopefully we might see you finishing Churchill's Body Count. Have you done any more work on that?
Well, I've had a look at the amount of material that I've got, what I'd saved on the computer. And I don't think there's that much to do, really. Maybe another episode, if that.
How many have you done so far?
Do you know what? It's either four or five. I can't remember.
I think you planned on doing six. I seem to remember.
I may have done. But I think I put one of them together. I put the German, for Versailles, they were starved, as Churchill will tell us. They were starved for a year, so they signed the Versailles Treaty. I think I put that with the Gallipoli right at the end because the Gallipoli, although a massacre, wasn't the massive total which the German starvation was. So I didn't want to make him look any better than he is.
Yeah, I think maybe we did seven or eight episodes on it on Truthful Out Radio.
Oh, check it out. I mean, it's a sizable amount as we stand.
And people can check out the audio version of it where we go into a lot more detail than you'll find in the videos. It's in the sidebar at the radioalbion.com site. And also you'll find Money Tree Publishing under the Truth Will Out Films advert. That's in the sidebar as well. And part of that price that goes for that DVD, that goes to your good self as well, Dennis, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I've never really asked for donations. And when the DVD were on sale, I did get a portion of it before. But it hadn't been on sale for over a year because of the people at the website have gone quiet, which concerns me. Anyway, Dave took it on hand to pick up the gauntlet, and I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, so if people want to donate, that's the way to do it, buy yourself a DVD or two, and also you're supporting Money Tree Publishing, which publishes alternative views on history, and hopefully he's going to get more books up there and more DVDs. So you're also supporting a nationalist company there, and you're also helping to support Dennis for the work that he does. So it's well worth getting a copy from there. Well, we're going to get into Trotsky again tonight, aren't we?
Yes, the famous Trotsky.
Yeah, and this we've taken notes from Scarlet and the Beast, A History of the War Between English and French Freemasonry, which was written by John Daniel, published in 1995. And we have some other notes as well that I've added to the rest of it tonight. Some of them have come from Wikipedia. I guess we should start with a recap of what we were talking about last week. We talked about Trotsky's links to French Freemasonry and how they protected him from incarceration throughout Europe when he was in Europe. We also discussed his newspaper Natchelo that was used to encourage Russians to expect a violent revolution. We talked about how Max Warburg read the newspaper and saw that here was a man he could use to spearhead a revolution in Russia, and he began funding him. And of course, Max Warburg is a huge, huge banker. English Freemasonry and the Rothschilds were responsible for the first coup that took place in the Duma, which put Kerensky in charge, but they were not prepared for a counter-revolution funded by French Freemasonry, which was being planned in New York by the fugitive Trotsky, along with Jacob Schiff and Max Warburg. And it was the threat of America not joining in the war on Britain's side that led to the British setting Trotsky free when he was apprehended in Canada on his way to meet up with the other cutthroats in Russia and start the Bolshevik Revolution. And that was something that I'd always wondered, is quite how that happened and how Trotsky was able to make his way from America to Russia. Well, that was it. It was the putting America into the war, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think it was Michael Johns who did a great piece on it, which included in Communism by the Back Door, which explained why, what they had in common, people like Schiff and Warburg with out-and-out ruffians like Lenin and Trotsky. And obviously, it weren't that they were just Jews. The fact was that they hated Christianity as well.
A lot of people were using this. A lot of people were using this bribe, weren't they, of bringing America into the war. That's two groups there, isn't it? We had the Balfour Declaration, if you give us Palestine, we'll bring America into the war. And then you've got here as well, you better let go of Trotsky, otherwise we'll stop America from coming into the war. And it's quite a bargaining chip there, wasn't it?
I don't think Britain were doing that well at the time. But it just goes to show. I mean, somebody said to me once, "What was the Balfour, declaration actually true?" And on YouTube, may still be there. I don't know. A lot of videos have been taken down, but it actually had Rothschilds talking about the wonderful Mr. Balfour and all about this agreement, to ensure Israel.
Well, the BBC did a big program on it on the anniversary of it. The Balfour Declaration is, that's all documented. Whether or not the idea of bringing America into the war in exchange for the Balfour Declaration, whether that is common knowledge as a part of history, I don't know. I think it is. I think it is.
Well, it's probably known, but probably not taught in schools.
It was exposed by Benjamin Freeman, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, and he's done a lot of good work.
Well, it was, what did we get to here? When they got to Russia, they began their slaughter just 1 month after America had joined the war, with Lenin and Stalin joining Trotsky and overthrowing Kursky's government before installing their own dictatorship of the proletariat through force. Due to the middle class sympathising with Kerensky's socialist views, the proletariat came from the slums and the prisons of Russia and Siberia. It wasn't the workers. It wasn't the workers of the world uniting. It was all the criminals and the cutthroats and the thugs and the bandits that were uniting. And once the October Revolution was over and they had taken full power, Trotsky assembled and led the Red Army, conscripting the entire male population and adopting the Masonic pentagram as its emblem. And that's still the Soviet emblem to this day, is the pentagram. And nobody can really come up with a better explanation for that. Dr. Johnson said last week that it may have been the five continents, but how that fits in when the Soviets weren't in power over the five continents, I don't know. And a lot of people do say, well, this was specifically it. It was a Masonic symbol. It was the pentagram. And I don't know of anything else where they talk about it. I don't know what reasoning the Soviets actually gave for using that. but it's still used today, isn't it, in China and North Korea?
Yeah, well, a lot of the Bolsheviks were Satanists, so it doesn't surprise me.
Well, it certainly looks that way with some of the ritual slaughter that they got involved in, as we will hear as we go through this. Well, we'll begin with Trotsky's former commissar, and with a quote from him telling how Trotsky took over the Russian army with these ruffians. The Soviets eventually replaced the commanding officers and their staff, and the first thing the new militarists did was to break up the machinery of the Imperial Army and to remove Russia from the ranks of the Entente powers, which the Rothschilds had lined up against Germany. No one was better prepared for such a task. I have seen Trotsky at the height of his career, have witnessed his activities during the time he was dictator over Russia and director of all the revolutionary forces of the world. I know that no pagan war of the Dark Ages, no medieval crusade or inquisition has produced a more murderous leader than this beast. His large number of political commissars, which he had been organizing and instructing for months, together with their spy system within the army units, made every attempt to oppose him impossible. He did not hesitate to exterminate ruthlessly any individual or group which was suspected of disloyalty. The notorious Soviet Secret Service, first known as the Cheka and now existing as the GPU or KGB, was started by Trotsky as part of the military machine. It has always been a terror to both the civilian population and the army. So there's quite a lot there, just talking about how he formed the Red Army. But also we forget that this was during the time of the war between Russia and Germany. And they pulled out of the war, didn't they? Once this started.
That's right. Yeah, and you're listening there to a description, you know, maybe only on parallel with Stalin, as a, you know, a murderer of the highest degree. And just to throw this in, I didn't mention it last week, but for those people who think neocons are right wing, which is the general outlook, they're actually left-wing and they are actually Trotskyites, who follow Trotsky. So all the wars, like Iraq and Libya, whatever, which the neocons push for, were actually Trotsky revolutionists invading Iraq and Libya. Although the armies, the Christian armies as usual, Christian soldiers wouldn't know.
He was the start of this internationalist idea. It was international revolution, and he wanted international communism, international socialism, and he was expecting the workers in Germany to rise up and take over the factories and to join up with the Soviet Union. So they took a while to actually come to terms with Germany, because he wanted to wait for this to happen. And Lenin was saying, no, we've got to come to a peace treaty with them. And of course, as we heard last week, the Germans allowed Trotsky and Lenin to get in that train and to cross into Russia, because they knew what they were going to do to Russia when they got there. It wasn't a present they were giving them. It was a punishment. It was a weapon of war, basically, sending Trotsky in there.
Definitely.
Well, the duty of the Soviets was to eliminate the middle and the upper classes. De Pontsens confirms this in a quote from a man by the name of Latsis, and we don't have his first name available, and he was the director of the Red Terror in the Ukraine. He says, "We are not making war against individuals in particular. We are exterminating the bourgeoisie, the middle and upper classes as a class. Do not look in the inquiry for documents and proofs of what the accused person has done in acts or words against the Soviet authority. The first question which you must put to him is, to what class does he belong? What are his origin, his education, his instruction, and his profession?" So this was all about setting the people against one another. Nationalism is about all the classes working together and saying, it doesn't matter what class the person belongs to, if he's part of your extended ethnic kinship group, then he's your brother and you should be working with him. And it works to increase the bonds between the classes, whereas communism and international socialism, it sets the parts of the community against one another. So you've got the lower classes against the upper classes. And of course, the people that were doing this had been paid by the banks to do this. So they were front men to try and set the lower class, the working class, against the middle and the upper class. And of course, a lot of the people that are in the upper class, they're there because they have very high IQs. They're very intelligent. They're very resourceful people. And if you get rid of all the intelligent people, then you're not going to prosper. You're not going to invent new things. We can see the end result of that. And I don't mean to be insulting them here, but when you look at Ukraine, they've got the lowest average IQ in the whole of Europe. And they're also the poorest country in the whole of Europe. And that is down to the extermination of the upper class. That's down to the Red Terror. And part of the reason why the Ukraine are so against Russia, even though it was the Soviets and a lot of the Soviets weren't ethnic Russians, they still, you know, hold this animosity towards them.
They haven't forgiven them. No. Yeah,
you can completely understand it, can't you, really?
Totally.
You look at the effects are still happening now. Their average IQ is the lowest in Europe. This was the reason for it. Regarding the Red Terror, Trotsky would write, "The bourgeoisie is a falling class. We are forced to tear it off, to chop it away. The Red Terror is a weapon utilized against a class doomed to destruction, which does not wish to perish. If the White Terror can only retard the historical rise of the proletariat, the Red Terror hastens the destruction of the bourgeoisie." So I think what he's referring to there is the white Russians, and he's calling them the White Terror, because they were trying to resist this revolution, and he's still trying to claim that he's representing the proletariat here, and the white Russians are against them, and the Red Terror needs to destroy the upper class and the middle class in order to aid the rise of the proletariat. Of course, it didn't aid their rise at all. It starved them all to death, got rid of all the best people. Do you want to comment on any of that, Dennis?
Well, yeah, I mean, people today think that communism was a movement by the working class to overthrow the elites, when in fact what it really was a plan of the elites to control the working class or the masses. And so they're completely way off the mark when they go on about how wonderful communism is, because one day it will come home to roost.
Well, this is a thing, isn't it? I mean, there may have been some bad people involved in that upper class, but there also would have been people that understood that they were the aristocracy, and they would have still had a sense of noblesse oblige, and they would have still stood up for the working classes. I mean, we still have people today that are in the middle and the upper class that speak up for the rest of their nation, and they are the ones that the bankers had to take out the way, because they didn't want to have these powerful people, influential people that could stand in their way of controlling the proletariat. So the way to do that, set up your fake revolution, take out all the upper class, all the middle class, take all their wealth for yourself, and then rule with an iron fist. And it's the same that's happened throughout the world, North Korea, China. I mean, those countries may be better now, but this is originally how it started off, with just terror, killing people. Same with Pol Pot in Cambodia.
China, I think, with 50 million, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, China are social nationalists now. They didn't follow Trotsky's version of internationalism. China, they're proud of their nation. They're actually nationalists, but they follow communist ways within their nation, but they don't seek to turn the rest of the world into communists as well. That's the difference, I think. Consequently, those who were educated, those who knew how to run a business and a country, were slaughtered. How Russia was to survive economically and politically after killing the educated and skilled of the country was never considered by the ignorant, hate-crazed communists. Like the Grand Orient Jacobins of 1793, the Grand Orient communists destroyed old Russia economically and politically. These criminals made up Trotsky's Red Army and conducted the Red Terror with the best and most imaginative executioners being placed in the Cheka, the forerunner of the KGB. So the author's drawing a link there with the French Revolution and what went on there, because again, there you had thousands of people that were massacred, and they're all just killing one another and denouncing one another, and they had really debauched sexual side to it as well, lots of abortions and free sex plays into it. Everybody's free to do whatever they want to do, and then you'd be encouraged to do the absolute worst possible things that you wouldn't do if you had any morals.
All the other revolutions that Christianity suffered again in the French and every other revolution since.
Well, they go after the church and they go after the aristocracy, don't they, in equal measure. The monarchy and the church they seek to take down. And it's always been the monarchy and the church that stood up for the poor folk. But they managed to turn the people against them. And as we talked about last week, especially with Trotsky's newspaper and the power of propaganda. Mm-hmm. I mean, today, look at the way the propaganda turns people against nationalists, when nationalism means that they are the people that are that put your needs above everybody else's needs, and yet they make us out to be haters. You know, it's all the power of the press. A more plausible explanation of the Masonic elements of the Cheka is that the Cheka itself was an exclusively Masonic lodge. The Masonic symbols left on victims slaughtered by the Cheka suggest that the Cheka consisted of homicidal OTO Masons. That's the Ordo Templi Orientis. That's the Masons that were part of Aleister Crowley. Now this is August 1919. When was Crowley around? Because I'm not sure they could have been members of the OTO, Dennis.
Yeah, Crowley was around at this time.
He was around at this time, what, sort of turn of the century?
He got chased out of, well, he wisely left Germany the year before Hitler came to power. But his best friend was in prison.
Because this was 1919 is when this was happening.
Well, we're talking 33, Hitler came to power. So, 32, he left Germany. Because he knew, you can tell when there's a movement happening, and obviously National Socialism was happening, and he couldn't risk staying around.
Because I'm thinking, you know, they may have used these symbols, but the OTO probably got the symbols from somewhere before, and they may have just popularised them.
Could well be. I mean, they're still going today.
Yeah. And I mean, they were using like old ideas, weren't they? Black magic and all the rest of it. For example, after the White Russians recaptured Kiev, the expeditionary forces entered that city in August 1919. The expedition's Rorburg Commission of Inquiry found the execution hall of the Cheka in the following state. All the cement floor of the great garage, the execution hall of Departmental Cheka of Kiev, was flooded with blood. This blood was no longer flowing. It formed a layer of several inches. It was a horrible mixture of blood, brains, of pieces of skull, of tufts of hair, and other human remains.
Well, this is exactly what you're going to get when communism finally takes power. When you're looking at a floor flooded with blood, which is actually hardened with bits of blood and pieces of skull, tufts of hair, and human remains, then, you know, match that with all the walls, it'll be thousands of bullets, and you're starting to get the picture. At the end of the day, this Red Terror, which was called the insinuating, can't remember the final word, but that was insinuating brethren in the French Revolution, just the same. And I can tell you another quick story about when, if you can remember, not that long ago, back in America, when Obama brought in the border patrols, he brought them in about 30, 40 miles inland. And a lot of people in America who were traveling by car were being stopped and searched, which was against the Constitution. And somebody wrote on YouTube, "Oh, these are fascists." And I actually said, "No, you got it wrong. It's the Cheka." And apart from saying, "Who's the Cheka?" when I mentioned it was communism, half of YouTube laughed. Probably not laughing now.
Well, I've been to the KGB cells that they had in Riga, in Latvia, the torture cells, and they had... They had like a pool, and in the middle of the pool there was like a raised dais, and the prisoner would be stood on this dais. And of course, in the middle of winter, it was freezing cold, and the pool would be ice. And this raised dais was curved, and they'd be stood there naked, and they'd be constantly falling off this raised dais into the freezing cold water, and then get back up again. So, and that was just a normal cell where they would be tortured. I mean, they would torture these people as well.
They were sadists in many ways.
Absolute sickos. Continuing with this description here, and this is a description by the Commission of Inquiry when the White Russians recaptured Kiev in Ukraine. They say all the walls, riddled by thousands of bullets, were bespattered with blood. Pieces of brains and of scalps were sticking to them. A gutter 25 centimetres wide by 25 centimetres deep and about 10 metres long ran from the centre of the garage towards the subterranean drain. This gutter, along its whole length, was full to the top with blood. Usually, as soon as the massacre had taken place, the bodies were conveyed out of the town in motor lorries and buried beside the grave about which we have spoken. We found in a corner of the garden another grave, which was older and contained about 80 bodies. Here we discovered on the bodies traces of cruelty and mutilations the most varied and unimaginable. And, you know, you can just imagine this. It's like a slaughterhouse, isn't it? It's like a mechanized slaughterhouse, and then they've got the drains there for the blood. They've got lorries outside to take the bodies away, and they must have just been marching people in there and just shooting them in the head, and then they would have fallen down onto a conveyor belt, taken out to the lorry, driven off, and just buried in an unmarked grave altogether. It's absolutely inhuman what was going on here. You know, go on.
I was just going to say, similar in World War II, when in The Great Story Never Told, I show a clip of when these young German soldiers had been captured and they were laid out in a field and they'd had their bowels cut off and their eyes poked out before they died. Just a horrendous, horrible way of dying. And because, you know, the Soviets weren't part of this Geneva Convention, although Germany were, you know, he soon wised up and thought, you know, we'll give what we get. But I don't think even they went that far gouging either.
Yeah, I should imagine they just didn't give them the Red Cross parcels and what have you. I don't think they would have been nearly as twisted as the Soviets were. It tells us here what they discovered. The mutilations described by the commission were definitive signs that the victims suffered from OTO Masonic ritual murders. For example, some bodies were disemboweled, while others had their tongues cut out. Mutilations descriptive of punishment given Masons who reveal secrets and or who talk. Some corpses had wedges driven into their hearts. Others had limbs chopped off and had literally been hacked to pieces. Others' eyes had been gouged out while they were still alive. The best evidence that the Cheka was nothing more than an OTO Masonic lodge performing satanic ritual murders were the numerous Masonic symbols carved into the flesh of victims' heads, faces, necks, and torsos. Now, you can't really argue with that, can you? If that's what
they found. No, not at all. Tells its story.
I mean, this must be really shocking for the businessman that's, you know, like a member of his local lodge and just sees it as a, you know, a meeting for businessmen, basically, that act as a charity to widows and orphans. And yet...
Well, not every Freemason is aware, that's for sure, but they were never meant to be aware, according to Pike.
These guys, I mean, these were all the robbers and the criminals. They must have been inducted into it to be doing this. Or do you think it was just the leaders of the Red Army that were carrying this out?
No, I think Freemasonry played a big part in it, as do all the rituals, you know, the Masonic rituals, like you said. But it's like, you know, when people say that, I did a video not long back say, proving that Stalin was a Freemason, after many people said he wasn't, you know, the fact that you have to have some kind of God, and Stalin and all the others were all atheists, so they couldn't be. Well, the Grand Lodge in France actually is the place for them people to go, and the God really is Lucifer. So, you know, they can't really call themselves atheists.
Well, the Tsar was killed in a ritual way as well. I mean, that was a ritual killing of the killing of the king and all his family as well.
Yeah.
And that's
a Kennedy, that, yeah.
It's been investigated now by Russia, finally, 100 years later, They're actually investigating it as a ritual sacrifice, the killing of the Tsar.
Mm-hmm.
Published in the Scotsman on November the 7th, 1923, are the following counts of the slaughtered. 28 bishops, 1,219 priests, 6,000 professors and teachers, 9,000 doctors, 54,000 officers, 260,000 soldiers, 70,000 police, 12,950 property owners, 535,250 members of the intellectual and liberal professions, 193,290 workmen, and 618,000 peasants. And I wonder if that was just there in Kiev, in that...
It could well be.
In that killing room.
Sounds like there's a lot of middle-class tech out there as well.
The Denikin Commission of Inquiry reported 1,700,000 victims slaughtered during 1918 and 1919, and by the winter of 1920, another 1,500,000 were butchered. A total of 3,200,000 innocent Russians went to their graves in this benevolent Grand Orient working man's paradise. Their only crime was that they belonged to the middle or the upper class. So they're people that have made something of their lives and were probably sharing their wealth as well and had given employment to the people that were in the lower class.
And that's looked on as a crime.
Yeah, well, it would have only been a small fraction of them that were just making their money from usury or from being a landlord and you know, charging too much rent. The majority of them would have been people that were contributing. And this idea of greed, of this person over there, he's got more than you, he doesn't deserve that, so you should take it. You know, that's such an alien way to think. I don't think white people think like that. If you see somebody that is better off, you know, we used to think, well, I'm very glad for that person. You know, this is why everybody used to really like the king so much. You know, be really glad for him. He's got all this wealth, lucky man. I'm very pleased that he has it. At least somebody has a good life and has had a good education. And he's not just somebody, he's somebody that's standing up and speaking for me. You know, that's the way it should be looked at. Not, oh, why does he have it and I don't? I should take it.
Yeah, it's going back to the Stone Age, that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it goes against morality, isn't it? This was all about turning morals on their head and turning society on its head.
Like we see today, same thing.
Yeah, well, this reset, isn't it? The Great Reset.
Abortion's looked on as moral.
This great reset that they're using COVID as an excuse for, mm-hmm. you know, that someone I was listening to someone on Patriotic Weekly Review this week, and he was saying about how the attacks on our history, where they're rewriting our history and they're getting rid of anything colonial, anything to do with the British Empire. And that ties in with getting rid of money and COVID. And it's just like the year zero of the communists, where they wanted to abolish all of history and start again. And that's what we're seeing when they're rewriting history and saying that it was filled with black people and Britain was built by black people. It's the same as this communist idea of rewriting everything and saying it was all the workers and they were oppressed by the bourgeoisie. And now we're being told it was all black people that built everything and they were being oppressed by the white man.
Funny you say that, because there's over in Hollywood, the precedent now is if a producer doesn't include a black person, no matter what period of history, then they immediately they're out of the running for an Oscar. So they're being forced now to implement this false narrative if they want to get an Oscar. And there's plenty there once, so we'll be watching false history for a fair amount of time to come.
It's really important that we protect our history. You know, I mean, it's being attacked all the time. Everything about our traditions and our culture is being attacked from children's books, television programs, history, everything. And people that speak up for us are being cancelled. It's so similar to what was going on here. I mean, this is a warning from history that we're talking mm-hmm. about here. The Bolsheviks, of course, enthroned man as God and attempted to banish God from all private and public society. Shortly after the success of the revolution, in an act of grotesque irony, which revealed the true nature of the Masonic Communist Revolution, the Bolsheviks proposed to erect in Moscow a statue to Judas Iscariot, who they said hanged himself in despair over the thought of what humanity must suffer under Christianity. So they make Judas Iscariot out to be a hero.
Yeah.
A story published in the Ost Express, January 30th, 1923, and in the Berliner Tagblatt, May 1st, 1923, reveals how widespread and endemic to Bolshevism was the hatred of the revealed God of Christianity. The story reports that Trotsky was presiding over a meeting in Moscow that same year, a meeting organized by the propaganda section of the Communist Party to judge God. 5,000 men of the Red Army, men who claimed there was no God, were present to see God judged. Quote, the accused was found guilty of various ignominious acts, and having had the audacity to fail to appear, God was condemned in default. Close quote.
You couldn't write it in a book, could you?
But I'm sure I've heard of this as well, that they, you know, they tried to try God, basically, and tried to put him in the dock. It reminds me a bit of the rabbis saying that God listens to the rabbis, and the rabbis had a vote and God had to do what the rabbis told him. That's one of the stories in the Talmud, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we did a part on Secret Masonic Victory where the part was the attempt to kill God with all their ways and means of trying to debunk the Bible and everything else. So, yeah, it's not surprising to put him on trial then.
I guess they try to tie that in with Gnosticism as well, and the dying God and the hangman and all this black magic sort of stuff is tied in with the killing of God, isn't it? They try to pretend that is somehow what Christianity really was, and really all of that sort of stuff is a pale copy of Christianity to distract people from it, distract people from the truth. There was a massive death toll, of course. The civil war between the right, the whites and the reds, which lasted from 1919 to 1922, caused the death of 28 million Russians, more than 16 times the number of men that Russia lost during World War I, and the famine that swept the land starved another 5 million. And I think that's a very conservative estimate. I think we'll find it could well have been a lot more than just 5 million. With so many absurdities and brutal atrocities, the Bolshevik Revolution began to crumble. William T. Still, the author of New World Order, writes that Lenin had to admit that Marxism as an economic system was a failure. He instituted a radical economic reform, where he eliminated the Marxist barter system and returned currency and wages to the Russian people. In less than a year, 3/4 of all retail distribution was in private hands. Peasant farmers were allowed to sell most of their grain on the open market, and in a matter of months, starvation began to disappear. I'm interested in exactly when it was that happened. I guess it may tie in with what we're going to have a look at next here, with the famines. The deliberate slaughter did not kill as many as the created famines did that followed. So let's just stop right there, because we've just been told that the deliberate slaughter killed 28 million Russians. We're told that the immediate famine afterwards killed 5 million. And now we're being told that the created famines that followed killed even more than 30 million Russians. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
Really?
Deliberate famines, deliberately done. Later called the reorganization of agriculture, Trotsky's agents had taken for themselves every piece of farm equipment that could be converted into money. When widespread food shortages resulted, the Red Army ruthlessly confiscated every bit of grain they could find. If the Red Army suspected the farmers of hiding small quantities of grain for their own needs or for seed, mass executions followed. Cattle were slaughtered and horses taken for the Red Cavalry or used for military transport work. The immediate result of Trotsky's reorganization of agriculture was the famine of 1921 to 1922. To the rescue came American Freemason and Reform Jew Armand Hammer. 27 million people in a nation that had previously exported grain to all the parts of Europe had to be fed by the American Relief Administration and auxiliary organizations headed by Hammer, who made his first $1 million on this venture. So they're already making money out of this famine on the American side.
Let a good crisis go to waste, as they say.
Yeah, this is Freemason and Reformed Jew. He's making money out of it on the American side. And in 1945, Stalin himself told Winston Churchill that during that period, 12 million peasants died in the reorganization of agriculture alone. So that's Stalin boasting about it. Wikipedia actually reduces that number down to 5 million, which actually comes from an official Soviet textbook from the time, which would obviously seek to play down the numbers. So that's interesting, isn't it? This book that we're actually using to get the notes from, the anti-Masonic book, it's actually using the official Soviet figure there, where it says 5 million. The same as Wiki. So they're not trying to exaggerate things here. They're using the most conservative estimate.
Well, all the while, don't forget that the press were in from the West in Russia at the time, all came back and said everything was fine. There was no knowledge of this at all in the West.
Yeah, it was just one guy that managed to smuggle out the pictures, wasn't it? And actually, there were communists in America, communist journalists who knew exactly what was going on, and they were covering it up. And that's been exposed as well since then. About this workers' paradise that was being built in Russia while there were 5 million people starving and being forced to eat their own children. Those famous pictures of the cannibals that you can find on Google Images, the black and white ones, where they've got the bits of the body on the table that they've been eating, that was from this time. And those horrific pictures of the people with the ribs sticking out and just horrific, living skeletons. There were all these reports of children being snatched and eaten at the time as well.
Satanic.
Wikipedia does, however, admit that the peasants were forced to resort to cannibalism. Throughout 1922 and 1923, as famine was still widespread and America was still providing relief supplies, that's through this Hammer, who made his first $1 million doing this, grain was being exported by the Soviet government to raise funds, which seriously endangered the Western support for the relief. The new Soviet government insisted that if the relief was to be suspended, a foreign loan must be arranged instead for them of around $10 million. The relief fund was unable to do this, so it continued to ship the food in, going past the grain that was being sold abroad. Incredible, isn't it? So you can actually see why the people that were doling out the food and the relief could see why it was there was a famine happening, because going past them were these trucks filled up with grain that was being taken out of the country to be sold abroad. And they said, we need to do this because we need to get the money together to rebuild the infrastructure and rebuild everything that we destroyed during the Red Terror. And that was their excuse. So we got what we can see is that you can see the Soviets are making money from this, from selling the grain. And this Mason, this Hammer in America, he's making money out of this as well. And the people that are suffering, as usual, are the peasants. The church comes into this as well, an attack on the church. The Bolsheviks started a campaign of seizing church property in 1922, and in that year, over 4.5 million golden rubles worth of church goods were seized. Out of this, just 1 million gold rubles were spent for famine relief. And this is because they used the famine as an excuse. They said, well, the church has got all this money, so we're going to have to take everything from the church. But they only gave 25% of what they took from the church to the famine relief. So where did that three quarters of a million golden rubles go?
Exactly.
In Trotsky, Lenin and Stalin's back pocket? Or was it siphoned off to the bankers?
Shipped over to Schiff and Warburg.
Schiff and Warburg, yeah. In a secret letter that Lenin wrote to the Politburo at the time, he explains that the famine provides an excellent opportunity to rob the church. Richard Pipes argues that the famine was used politically as an excuse for the Bolshevik leadership to persecute the Orthodox Church, which still had significant support from much of the peasant population. So it's like, never let a good tragedy go to waste, is it? We'll use this chance to rob the church, which is what we've always wanted to do anyway. Russian anti-Bolshevik white émigrés in London, Paris and elsewhere used the famine as a media opportunity to highlight the iniquities of the Soviet regime in an effort to prevent trade with the Soviets and any official recognition of the Bolshevik government. So that's what was happening here in 1922. So we obviously had some of these Russian refugees, asylum seekers that were in London, that were bringing this to the attention of Churchill and the rest of them that were in Parliament, because this is around the time that Churchill was condemning communism, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he was a Zionist more than a communist, but a bit of both, really, when you think he was involved in the EU as well.
Well, he was on the side of the Rothschild Freemasons rather than the Warburg Freemasons. Mm. Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. The two different sides that... And how world politics, geopolitics, is affected by this power play between these two factions in the secret society. Well,
it always amazes me. Well, because of the amount of mass killings that the communists are known for, it always amazes me that, you know, you can walk around with a T-shirt of a revolutionary, or, you know, they've got a Facebook, like I mentioned earlier, Facebook page, the Marxist archive. Amazing.
Well, you got Ash Sarkar talking about what is it she calls it, champagne socialism, something like posh communism, some ridiculous term she calls it. She's a celebrity communist. You got them all wearing their Che Guevara t-shirts, talking about Fidel Castro. But they won't support the communist nation that is still there today, though. They won't support China, interestingly enough. They're all against China. That's because China is, as I say, it's nationalist more so than communist. But nobody gets any censure for praising communism. And they all say, oh, it's just because it wasn't tried properly. Didn't do it properly. If only we did it properly, then maybe 100 million people wouldn't have died. I think that's the number that people go with, isn't it? Russian communism, China communism, Cambodia, North Korea, and all of it together, 100 million dead from this ideology.
Yeah, probably only Cuba didn't do a mass killing, for as I know. That was like a one-off.
One of the few ones that didn't. It is all just based on greed, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's an ideology which fools people. You know, people say to me, do you really know what communism is? Yeah, no more than you.
It's like they're tempting them with greed and they're accepting the temptation to go out and kill and steal and take what they think should be theirs out of jealousy and greed. And then they're repaid for giving into that temptation by having their countries destroyed, their lives destroyed, and the average intelligence of the people lowered, and then they're ruled by absolute devils because they gave into this temptation.
Yeah. I mean, like down in the Balkans, Alice family after World War II, we were talking about this not long back when they went on the death marches. They were sent back to the communists by Churchill, went on the death marches, and you can Google the fact that they found a recently disused mine. There's 28,000 women, children, granddads, soldiers, and covered in concrete, left to die.
Well, I wonder how much Masonic influence there was in the treatment of the Russians at the end of the war, because we did a podcast on it, didn't we, with the Russians that had managed to escape from Russia, and they were in the prisoner of war camps in Germany, and they were liberated by the British. And you also had a lot of other Russians that had escaped to Germany and Axis countries, and they were all brought to Britain, and they were kept in camps in Britain. And, you know, they thought that they'd come to a safe country, and they were all handed back to the Soviets, weren't they?
Yeah, I think it was at Yalta the agreement was made with Stalin.
and all the Croatians, the Croats, and yeah. all the other Slavs that were just sent back to the slaughter.
Yeah, and I think not long after that, about 4 or 5 years after the war, the Soviet Union claimed that it was a different place and, you know, welcomed people back. It's going to be different. And people fell for it, and they went back as soon as they got off the boats of the plane.
I think a lot of Jews did, you know. And I think that ties in with, you know, with the numbers that they say that died in the German camps. I think there is one theory that a lot of the Jews actually did believe that, and they did go to Russia, and they ended up never being heard of again. You know, that they met the same fate as the bourgeoisie once they got there.
Amazing, yeah.
And you know, this story of the Holocaust, it covers up a lot of the massacres and the crimes that went on in the Soviet Union.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the Nuremberg trials didn't even touch on it, did
they? I mean, these were atheist Jews that were involved in communism. They did speak Yiddish, and they did they didn't damage the synagogues, but on the whole, they were atheist Jews. They were against the religious side of Judaism, and that was why they were against Zionism. Partly why they were against Zionism. They didn't want people to follow this religion. They wanted the Jews to follow communism and be atheists, but still remain Jews, of course.
Yeah, well, that's for people to decide. But I think the history of communism, if anybody really looks into it, can work it out.
There's overwhelmingly a Jewish influence, particularly at the beginning. I mean, all these leaders, the rabble-rousers, were all Jews just looking for a chance to get their own back on people because they felt that they had been persecuted by people. Whether they had been or not is a different matter, but they felt that they had been and they wanted to get their own back. And this is how it ended up. In May 1922, Lenin had a cerebral stroke, and after a series of such attacks, he died in January 1924. On his deathbed, he said, "I committed a great error. My nightmare is to have the feeling that I'm lost in an ocean of blood from the innumerable victims. It is too late to return to save our country, Russia. We would have needed men like Francis of Assisi. With 10 men like him, we could have saved Russia." I'd like to know where they get that recording of him actually saying that, because I should imagine if he did say that, that would have been hidden from the rest of the Soviets, because they looked at him.
I would have thought so, yeah, when he's praising a monk.
Yeah, well, I mean, they looked at him like some kind of god, didn't they? They embalmed him and put him in this glass coffin
so that
people could go there and worship him, to think that he turned his back on it all and said, "I've made a great big mistake." I mean, that's a rarity. I think William Bastard, I think on his deathbed, he did similar, said, "I've done a terrible thing. I've been a really horrible person, and I've massacred loads of English people and stolen a country and kicked the Welsh out." Apparently, he did. He had a change of heart on his deathbed. With Lenin increasingly sidelined throughout 1922, Stalin was elevated to the newly created position of the Central Committee General Secretary. Zinoviev and Lev Kamenev became part of the Troika, the triumvirate formed by Stalin to ensure that Trotsky, who was publicly the number two man in the country and Lenin's heir presumptive, would not succeed Lenin. So there'd been a falling out here, and I think the falling out really went back to that bit in the First World War when Trotsky wanted to hold out rather than make peace with Germany, and Lenin wanted to make peace with Germany, and so did Stalin. And because Trotsky wanted to hold out, that they didn't for quite some time, and maybe they were blaming Trotsky for that, for the reason why they had the famines, or parts of the famines, even though they were man-made. I think maybe they blamed Trotsky for that and for holding back.
I think they blamed him for the failed German Revolution as well.
For expecting that to happen.
Yeah,
and it didn't happen. So there had been this falling out before now, but the public still like him. If he was the number two man in the country and Lenin had said, you know, "This is the guy I want to succeed me," they still had a lot of work to do to prevent the public from calling for Trotsky. But I guess, you know, the public would have just been so downtrodden by now, not much chance of them revolting, is there?
I wouldn't have thought so, notwithstanding about.
On the surface, Trotsky remained the most prominent and popular Bolshevik leader, although his mistakes were often alluded to by Troika partisans. Behind the scenes, he was completely cut off from the decision-making process. So I guess what started happening then was they would put out propaganda pointing out things that he'd done wrong and exaggerating them and blaming him for things in the past to generally turn the people against him. Joseph Stalin, then a 33rd degree Rosicrucian Freemason, became embroiled in a power struggle with Trotsky. Stalin won, continuing the bloodbath for the Masonic hierarchy. Stalin sent to the grave over 40 million Russians, it says here, four times the number, slaughtered by Hitler. Did Hitler really slaughter anyone? Hitler was fighting in a war. That's the difference here. This is somebody killing his own people here, whereas Hitler was defending Germany against the rest of the world. So I wouldn't say that Hitler slaughtered people. The Germans were defending themselves. Stalin, however, was a Mason, and thus information or news of the magnitude of his slaughter was hidden and suppressed for years. And I don't know if we really want to continue here. Have we got enough time? Because we're going to have a little bit to do next week here. We'll talk a little bit about the rivalry here. The rivalry between Stalin and Trotsky in the mid-1920s was fought with slogans as well as with more violent weapons. Trotsky called for world revolution, while Stalin wanted communism in a single country. So that gives us a clue there, doesn't it? Because people have said Stalin was like a nationalist leader. He wanted communism, but he wanted it just within Russia, whereas Trotsky was saying, well, we want internationalism. And that's not to say that Stalin didn't want to take over other countries, but he wanted them to be separate countries following communism. And I guess that's why, now that the Soviet Union has fallen apart, and we can see that those countries in Eastern Europe, they are all fiercely nationalist. They're all very ethno-nationalist. They're very proud of their nations, and they don't want outsiders coming in.
No, that's true.
They did give them new flags, though. I know in Latvia, it was, you know, you get sent to the gulag if you got caught with the original Latvian flag. Same in Lithuania. So they didn't want them to be patriotic at all for their country. They wanted them to identify with communism, but he wanted the patriotism to just apply to communism in that country and not to the history of the country before the communists took over. So it's not like he was...
Speaking of which, I saw an artist who was working on a new Union Jack, by the way, a more multicultural coloured Union Jack.
I think I might have seen that.
Yeah, that's more for the future.
When Stalin lowered the Iron Curtain to get help from America, and that was with the relief aid, Trotsky went into a rage, screaming, "You have betrayed the revolution! You have betrayed the revolution!" So I guess what they're saying there, Trotsky still, you know, really believed in what he was doing, maybe.
I dare say he did.
Whereas, you know, I'm not sure Stalin did.
As a psychopath would.
Yeah, but I mean, did he really think that he was going to get the rest of the world to rise up and that there would be an improvement in conditions for everyone? I guess the Trotskyists would say that, yes, he did. He was genuine.
Well, they're still at it today, aren't they? I mean, Bush is a Trotskyite.
Yeah, all the neocons.
As is the rest of them.
All the neocons, but he was certainly not happy about them getting help from America. But what else could they do when everybody's starving and dying?
Well, capitalism's always funded communism. Communism's never been able to sustain itself.
And Stalin's obviously quite happy to compromise his principles, isn't he? But he's got no principles. Don't care what he's doing, you know, if he
exactly
can increase his wealth. And as we learned in the first episode, he was a bandit, wasn't he? He was a bank robber.
I like to call him a fundraiser.
Communist fundraising, yeah, through terrorist bank robberies. Right, we're getting near the end of the podcast now, Dennis. I think we'll have to leave it here. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.